The next case is 97-1117, Doris Simmons-Harris versus Jim Goff, Superintendent of Public Instruction.
Third row. Second row. Second row, right here inside.
Justice Stratton has recused himself in this case. We're pleased to have sitting in place of Justice Stratton, Judge William Young, who is the judge of the Court of Appeals in the 12th District. Justice Cook has recused herself. We're pleased to have sitting in place of Justice Cook, Judge William Baird, who is the judge of the Court of Appeals, sitting in the 9th District. Mr. Sutton.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Please, the court, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal commentary. In assessing plaintiff's claims this morning, it is appropriate not to lose sight of this uncontested fact. Not one penny flows to a private or public school under the scholarship program except the mandatory and intervening choices of the one group of citizens in the state most capable of deciding how to educate our youth, and that's our parents. Now, what group of parents gets this choice? Well, to put it plainly, this is a group of individuals living hard lives. The average income of the families eligible for the scholarship program in its first year was a mere $6,500 per family. Now, what choice are they making? Well, there's no more fundamental choice a parent makes than where and how their children ought to be educated.
Counselor, maybe back up just to your first statement. You said nothing flows to anyone but parents.
Exactly, Your Honor. Exactly.
But it doesn't. It flows. But what is the profession? What is the school? Is it not a requirement or endorsement of the check?
Actually, Your Honor, the terms of the statute on its face simply say the money goes to parents. It says nothing about going to schools. Parents are allowed to have checks sent to the schools, and in fact, that is what has happened under the program in its first year, as in the Wisconsin program.
Is it possible for a parent to get a check directly?
It is, and here's what can happen. For example, if a parent has already paid their tuition to that school, they keep the check. In other words, the state of Ohio writes a check, it's to the parent, it goes to the school, the parent goes to the school, and it turns out they've already paid all of their tuition, either for that semester or for the year. That check is theirs and that money is theirs. If, however, they have not paid their tuition and they still want to enroll their kid in the school and participate in the scholarship program, then they endorse it to the school. That's exactly right.
But they do that down at the school.
That's the way it's being implemented in its first year. And that's simply an administrative convenience. One risk, obviously, is if you send it straight to the parents, there's a possibility it might not be spent in education. There's one goal in this program, I think we all can agree, plaintiffs and defendants alike, is to help kids and parents not to advance the education or, advance schools. Now, the court is not writing a clean slate in addressing this issue. From 1947, the Everson decision, all the way to the Agostini decision just last year, in that 15-year time, the court has said there are two safe harbors in assessing these types of school choice programs. The first is that the state has got to break the link between church and state. That's done here by giving the scholarship to families and not to schools. The second thing you've got to do, and this was the problem in NICLIS, is you've got to make sure that the parents have a wide range of choices available to them when it comes to spending or using that particular scholarship.
But isn't that what's the problem in this case? The fact that the vast majority of schools involved are religious schools.
Your Honor, that is a point that plaintiffs have pushed, I think, perhaps more aggressively than any other. I would say, however, that it's a point that is more clearly defeated by precedent than any other they've brought, and that's for this reason. First of all, in the Supreme Court's decision in Mueller in 1983, the court said we would be loath to ground the constitutionality of the statute on the statistics from year to year as to which individuals participate in the program and which don't. In that case, plaintiffs alleged that 96% of the benefits went to religious schools. But if there was any doubt about that point, it was removed in Agostini a year ago, and it's not fair to criticize the Court of Appeals since when Agostini was decided after their decision. But Agostini made clear again that you do not look at the validity of these programs based on the statistics from year to year. The one thing the court has not said is why that's so, and I think there's a good reason why that's so. What the 14th Amendment is about, what the First Amendment is about, what the Ohio Constitution provisions are about state action. It's about the state steering money to religion. It's about the state inculcating religious beliefs. When the state, however, merely sets up a scholarship program like the GI Bill and allows individuals to decide what to do with that benefit, they're not involved in the choice. And that's the critical point. State action is not in existence. That those individuals are as free to spend their money on the education of their child as one of us is, as a state employee, to take our paycheck and endorse it to a religious group.
Council, Wisconsin has a similar program, and they've had a test made through their Supreme Court.
Yes.
In looking at that, Superior Wisconsin started out by saying this will just, you can't go to religious schools. And then they expanded the program. So one approach that the state could take is to exclude use of the statute and religious school.
Your Honor, I would respectfully submit that the state of Ohio did not have that option. We've made this argument from the outset. If one decides, and I want to make sure I'm answering your question, I think I am. If one decides to set up a government benefit, in this case, a benefit that could be used in private schools, and one says that the only people that can use those benefits are those who are non-religious, those who do not want to use them in a religious setting, you run the risk, in fact I would say it's more than a risk after Rosenberger, it's of this serious likelihood, of discriminating on the basis of religion. As the court made clear in Rosenberger, the key goal of the state is to steer clear both of the free exercise clause and the establishment clause. And the way to do that, when you have a government benefit, is to make sure that it's available to everybody, religious or non-religious.
The Wisconsin Constitution, somewhat similar to ours?
Your Honor, many of the same provisions at issue here were issued there. They've got a uniformity clause, a single subject. They have Ohio provisions like the Ohio Constitution control support clause. There are similarities. One thing I would say, though, is I would say our case actually is easier than the Wisconsin case because ours was made available to public school students, particularly through the tutorial permits.
Counsel, do you see any problem with the one subject rule in this case?
Your Honor, I do not. And I'd ask the court to look at two cases on that point. The first case is Dix, which makes clear you can have a substantive program and an allocation of money. The second case, Your Honor, that helps deal with this problem is Comtech, where they did the exact same thing, but in the context of the biennial appropriation approach, which is exactly the setting in which the school scholarship program was put together. In Comtech, the plaintiffs there made the exact same charge they made here, which is that the biennial appropriations bill not only allocates an awful lot of money.
But doesn't this contain a variety of other subjects, other bills involved? Doesn't it?
Absolutely, Justice Sweeney. Just as it did in Comtech, I would submit.
But essentially, because Comtech was decided the way it was, is that correct? If we do not find a violation of the one subject rule, wouldn't we in effect be saying that in the appropriation bill you can include any type of subjects, whether they're creating new programs or simply funding old programs?
That's an important question, Your Honor, and that would not be what would happen. And here's why. Not every type of legislation requires an allocation of money. In fact, if you look at the revised code, most laws do not. Let me give you one great example of that. Criminal laws do not require allocations of money. You could not simply throw criminal laws in the biennial budget because you'd be missing the critical rationality link you need. The rationality link you need under Comtech is that you've got a bill which is allocating money to different programs.
Even though they're not established programs, you're saying that it's perfectly permissible to create new programs and unrelated programs.
The reason I say that, Your Honor, is because if it's a program that requires an allocation of money, it wouldn't I think it would be a very difficult thing for the legislature to say, okay, in light of the single subject rule, we've got to create the program this year, but we'll wait 1 or 2 years before we can fund it. If a certain types of laws, by definition, require funding, and I think this is, I hope the key answer to Justice Scalia, your question, yours, Justice Resnick, is that most laws don't require that. And that's why this won't create a significant loophole in a single subject bill, which I agree with you is an important provision.
It's a major provision in this case, and before we ever get to the religion-based argument, we have to get over this hurdle. And ComTech really doesn't say what you're saying it says, does it, Mr. Sutton? Let me read to you what it really says. It may contain a new object of taxation because the tax funds government operations described elsewhere in the Act. So we're dealing with an appropriation bill and deals with the operations of the state government. It may contain a new object of taxation because the tax funds go to fund the others. Now, wasn't it related? Didn't we say in ComTech that it didn't violate the one subject rule only because the taxation relates to appropriations and funds the appropriations?
Well, I don't want to disagree with you, Justice Douglas, about...
Well, do. That's why I asked you.
The point I would make is that the tax is no different from any other substantive program in this respect. Some substantive laws require money. And that, I think, is the animating purpose of Dix and ComTech. And that's it. If you create a program that requires money, by definition, you've got to have an allocation to be back to the problem I mentioned with Justice Resnick.
Let's go through a short series of questions. If the General Assembly passes a bill creating, and I understand federal navigational waterways, and so don't hang me up on that. It's just something that comes to my mind.
You don't have to worry about that.
The General Assembly decides they want to put locks in Lake Erie to stop the northeastern winds from flooding Toledo. They passed an appropriation. They put it in the subject. Single subject?
Is that a single subject problem? Mm-hmm. No, not in that legislation. No.
Because it creates the program for locks and finances
exactly.
It. Okay, now the General Assembly adds an appropriation provision to that to appropriate money for the locks. Still doesn't create a one subject problem, does it?
I agree with you.
And that's the Dix case, Dix
right.
And Celeste.
Right.
Then the General Assembly includes in this bill a program creating 100 new highway patrol officers. Runs into the one subject rule yet?
Well, you have to ask yourself. And
it does, doesn't it? I mean, there's no commonality between them at all.
Well, the commonality is just like the uniformity clause. Once you have an argument that there are different subject matters in a bill, you have a rational basis requirement. The rational basis test, and this is why you have to have a gross and fraudulent violation of the rule whatever to have a problem, the rational basis has to be a link between the different subject matters. In that particular hypothetical, the question would be whether there's any link here. What I would submit with respect to the biennial budget bill is that there's always a link.
I'm coming to that.
Okay.
Is there a link between the two I gave you?
I couldn't know.
One that you can see quickly.
Are you saying there wasn't appropriation? Did you say there was an appropriation?
I'm going to come to that, but I'll add
without
appropriation.
Without appropriation, I think you have a problem.
Okay. Now adding an appropriation, you're saying makes the two substantive subjects linked.
Unless it was, I would say that's probably not true because there's...
Good.
It's got
okay.
To be a budget
by... I agree. Okay, well, that's the next question then. Does now the General Assembly instead, because this is the reverse problem, this isn't adding an appropriation, not making it one subject. This is appropriations adding subjects to an appropriation bill. It's the reverse, isn't it? Because you can't, because in the case of, I mean, in this bill you have a program designed for nurses who are addicted to drugs.
Right.
That's in this bill.
Right.
You have something to create it to govern, to look at the governor's mansion.
Right.
You have something for the industrial relations department. In fact, there's something in that bill for almost everybody. Like 25 or 30 separate items, aren't there?
The lobbyists treat the bill that way.
Yeah, okay. I think that's the point. All right, so now you have the appropriations bill. Supposing you just have appropriations and nothing else. Is that a single subject?
That's not a single subject problem. I mean, that is one single subject, and that's not a
good,
violation.
Good, good. It's not a violation. It's
right.
Now you add to it
liquor options, programs for nurses that are addicted to drugs, an oversight commission for the governor's mansion, and providing 100 new highway patrolmen. And appropriate money for them. You already have the single subject, which is the appropriations. Doesn't that create more than one subject?
I would say it does not, and I think it's an appropriate, very important question. And first of all, it's important to go back to what this court said about this particular provision, that you've got to have a gross and fraudulent violation. That's number one. Number two, there is a reason, a very rational reason, for having the state do most of its spending decisions at one point in the biennial budget bill. The thing that I think is appropriate for the court to scrutinize, and I hope this is what you're getting, I think it is that you've got to scrutinize that the laws that are put in that bill are in fact connected to those appropriations. And here I think we've got an easy case, because here, without an appropriation, this law makes no sense.
Okay, and I'm willing to concede that you can appropriate for existing programs. Here you had to create the program before you appropriated. I mean, you wouldn't appropriate money for a voucher program without there being a voucher program, would you?
And that's true. So nor would one create a program that required money without allocating money. And that's the only point I'm making. You need an allocation.
Okay.
So this doesn't mean anything. Otherwise, these parents who have been sitting here saying, well, that was a great idea.
Right.
The execution of it is very good.
I agree. But you've created a program.
Right.
And it's a whole separate program. Separate, because we've already conceded that the appropriations bill is a single subject. You've conceded that.
Your Honor, that's true, as long as we're doing what the court in Dixon Comtech made clear.
Okay, and that's when we come to Comtech. Now, Comtech was an appropriations bill.
Yes.
And in that appropriations bill, somebody challenged, whatever it was, the tax.
Right.
And the tax was designed to raise the appropriations for the appropriations bill. All related, we said. And that's the exact language we used.
I agree, Your Honor. Here's the only point, and I hope we don't disagree on this point, but the only point I was making is, yes, the connection in context was the tax was raised for the money. The connection here was the law was passed to spend the money. I don't understand why one is rational and the other is not. They're both perfectly rational.
Well, because the two are related, the first two are related to taxation and appropriations. The second two are not.
But what you're saying is that were the law, and I hope you're not suggesting it is.
Here's what I'm suggesting. The General Assembly, maybe this would be a... strike that. The General Assembly could do this. They could come down one day a year in the biennium, and put everything in the appropriations bill and not have to pass anything else all year, and you would say it doesn't make any difference what the subjects are, so long as they appropriate some money for them, they're all connected.
No.
They could do that, couldn't they?
No, but if I said that, I'm not misspoken.
No, I'm suggesting they could do that, couldn't
no,
they?
Couldn't.
Why?
Every provision of criminal law cannot be part of that budget, biennial budget, because the passage of a new criminal law which says this is a felony does not require an allocation.
Strike the criminal law. Let's just stay with the civil law.
Most parts of the civil law, most laws that the General Assembly passes do not require allocations of money. But let me suggest a troubling consequence of the approach of saying in the biennial budget bill you cannot pass substantive legislation regarding money that's allocated. That would mean every budget bill, even though you're allocating money, as you indicated, in virtually every single government funding program, in that legislation, the General Assembly cannot do a very logical and sensible thing, and that's pass laws regarding each of those appropriations. That would be the consequence of that reading.
No. They would pass all the appropriations for all government operations, and then if they had a new program, then they would pass an appropriation for that. It's interesting, because I hadn't done this before, but Florida, West Virginia, South Dakota, Maryland, none of those states have had any problem with this. When they looked at it directly, for instance, the Florida case. If you looked at the Florida case, that specifically says an appropriation for higher education in an appropriations bill is unconstitutional, with an exact provision like our constitutional provision.
Well, Your Honor, Wisconsin provision is very similar as well, and they held that when it was a school voucher program. But I do...
But it isn't. It isn't. The Wisconsin provision says a public or local act, doesn't it, in that one subject section?
Your Honor, what I do need to point out that I've got two other...
I understand.
I'm going to provide it at time.
Okay.
It would be unfair to you to not do it.
All right. Well, I'm at the court disposal. The point on the single subject is Justice Douglas, is I think it's appropriate to look at it in a functional way. And we would all agree that the underlying objective of the provision is a good one, and that's to prevent law ruling. That's to prevent one group of lobbyists, one group of constituents from sneaking legislation into a large bill on the hopes that it will not get the scrutiny it deserves. And the one thing I would suggest about this case, which strikes me as a pretty appropriate answer, is that no one was surprised when this budget bill was passed that lo and behold, there was a scholarship program in it. This has got very careful scrutiny. In fact, it started out as a program that was going to apply statewide, and because of there being very aggressive opponents on one side, very aggressive proponents on the other, the General Assembly made what I think was an eminently sensible decision to do it on an experimental basis in only those school districts that were facing very difficult educational circumstances. So we can disagree perhaps about how content, and I'm obviously going to be very respectful as to what you think it means. That's the final word, not of course. But I think functionally it's very difficult to argue that there's a problem here on single subject grounds.
Thank you, Mr. Sutton. Mr. Bullock, take 3 minutes.
Please, the court. I'm Clint Bullock, representing Hope for Parents for Cleveland's Children and Individual Choice Families. I also had the honor of representing the Wisconsin program, and so we return to Justice Piper's question momentarily. Whatever the legal challenges involved in this lawsuit, the program before this court is an educational program. And for that reason, I would respectfully submit that two cases that have not been discussed are extremely salient to this court's consideration. The Duralt decision, in which this court reiterated the central focus of education in the Ohio Constitution, and in which this court described that case as about, quote, the opportunity to succeed and compete, which is exactly what we believe this program is all about. And Reed versus Reed, the decision of the Northern District of Ohio that transferred control of perhaps the nation's most troubled school system to the state, that has ramifications in both the uniformity clause context, because that is a relationship that the state has with no other school district in Ohio. One was, of course, the uniformity clause. There are two reasons why the court erred in that regard. First of all, well, actually, one error and one subsequent occurrence. The error was that it failed to recognize that the state has a unique relationship with the Cleveland School District as a result of a federal court order, which makes this actually not a general law, but a law that is specific to the district, because the state is essentially the local school board in with regard to Cleveland. So it was not only appropriate for the state to fashion remedial legislation relative to Cleveland, it was the state's duty to do so. Also, the law has been modified to make it possible so that subsequent school districts that are placed under the control of the state for educational or desegregation reasons would be included within the program. The other implication that Reed versus Reed has relates to the religion decision. And in that instance, there is a realm of school choices, not only the public school choices that are made for suburban schools by this program, but as the second Reed decision noted in 1996, part of the state's response to its new duties was to create parental choice within magnet schools, community model schools, and also basically district-wide choice in the desegregation context. This is one element of the parental choice range that is available to low-income parents within Cleveland. And most of those choices, in fact, are public. This is a point, by the way, that was made by the Wisconsin Supreme Court in noting that even though the Milwaukee program on its face relates specifically to private schools and now religious schools, there is a pre-existing range of public choices where money follows the children to the school of their choice. Returning to your earlier question, Justice Piper, there is a Wisconsin provision that is more stringent than the Ohio provision. It forbids the use of public funds for the benefit or support of private or religious schools. This constitutional, the constitutional provisions that we are dealing with in Ohio emanate from the Northwest Territory. And during the time of the Ohio Constitution, most education in Ohio took place within religious schools at public expense. And that's why the Ohio Constitution is very, very different from Wisconsin. I see that the red light is on, and
we want to follow the Wisconsin case is on appeal, but no decision yet.
That's correct. It is before before the U.S. Supreme Court on a pending cert petition. Just to conclude, the same federal constitution that guarantees equal educational opportunities and the state constitution that recognizes the central importance of education should not be used to deny these children only quality education they've ever had. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bullock. And Mr. Young, 3 minutes.
Well, here the money doesn't go directly to the institute, doesn't go directly to the religious institution.
That is correct.
It may be a circuitous route, but at least there's a break.
And that's what the courts have emphasized tremendously. As long as it is a neutral program to a broad class of beneficiaries without religious tests, then that has certainly been the most recent test by the Supreme Court. And in this particular instance, Justice Douglas, the grants don't go to a child because he's Jewish or Muslim, Catholic or some other Christian, they go because he's poor, and they go because he's underprivileged and needs educational assistance.
And I asked this question before, but I find it troubling, and I find it distinguishable from the other cases, is the fact that Ohio's program is almost all as it's applied to religious schools. You don't find that troubling, as long as we have the free exercise to undergo into the facts.
Justice Resnick, I wish I had more time. This is the case you could now be arguing. But let me tell you, first of all, the factual premise is incorrect. The record reflects that 20% of the schools in this case are not for religious sponsorship. 20% of the non-public schools, and that number is growing. The Hope Schools, as anyone knows, have done a tremendous job of establishing private schools and doing an excellent job of educating these children. So we start out with 20%. And then the legislation also requires that at least 50% of the children have to benefit by way of tutorial grants that are available in the public school. So now you have 20% of the schools not of a religious persuasion. You have at least 50% of the pupils receiving tutorial grants in the public school system. So I think to say that the overwhelming majority are religious is not quite accurate. As a matter of fact, the Ohio program has less a percentage than most any other program that you have considered, or that has been considered by the Vice Court's Justice Rusnik. I think the what we're concerned about here, and
let's get into this. You said we haven't explored enough. How far can you go? I mean, how much is too much? Could the state have a program, a voucher program, available to every student and be for the same amount as the median cost for public education in this state? And then let's add in one more hypothetical, but once that program is up in place, 90% of those students are attending religious-based schools. Is that past muster, so long as the voucher goes to parents?
It is because of the question that you asked that we started out our brief, Your Honor, by saying that since I represent non-public schools of seven different religious sponsorships, that we are not here to say that every single voucher program would necessarily be constitutional. I may differ from my other co-counsel in that regard. Our position is that we have here a very unique program responding to a very unique crisis in the Cleveland School District, and I'm here to espouse the constitutionality of that program. I might have some questions with the program that you raised, Justice Viper, but I don't think it's before us today, and I think it's important in response to your question to point out this very, very, very simple fact. Even the religiously sponsored schools, if children choose to elect them to get their state-accredited education, every one of them are charter schools. They fully comply with all state minimum educational standards. In order to receive this grant, and the record will show, you know what, they don't receive $2,250 or $2,500. $1,050, the average religiously sponsored school. And in return for that $1,050, they enter into a contract with the state to provide fully accredited state education in all the secular courses. Every single mandated course that's taught in the public school, they undertake the additional financial responsibility of providing remedial assistance to children so they can bring them up to grade level. Every one of their children must participate in the proficiency test program to make sure that they achieve well in the secular educational programs tested by the state of Ohio. So what we have here, the reason I'd rather not comment on your hypothetical, is what we have here is a program of if they choose to go to religiously sponsored school, a grant in the amount of $1,050, and in return, a total high-quality secular education, and in the record, we have shown the proficiency test results.
Counsel, you said this program was passed in response to a crisis.
Yes, Your Honor.
When the crisis is over, does the program over?
Well, this particular program is an experimental program, Justice Sweeney, and it's my understanding that this program was established to determine through the testing and results what impact choice could have on these parents. And one of the things they did...
Well, here, it's simple. You said that it's passed in response to a crisis in Cleveland, and that this is hoped to alleviate that problem. And all I'm asking is, once the problem is solved, does the program end?
And that would be up to the members of the Ohio General Assembly. In its present form, I think the answer is correct. But the General Assembly is also trying to determine what impact choice can have upon educational problems that may arise in other districts. I mean, as you know,
we're looking for other crises in other areas, are we?
Well, Your Honor, in DeRolf, I think that you very definitely identified crises throughout the state, maybe not quite to the magnitude of that in the Cleveland District, where you have 78% minority and 74% below the poverty level. But whether the crises will be eliminated soon, I'm not overly optimistic. But this is a pilot program, as I understand it, Your Honor, to determine what impact choice will have on resolution of potential crises.
Thank you.
Mr. Young, it seems to me in reading the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court cases, that if you look at the earlier cases, Nyquist and some of the earlier announcements, that the Supreme Court had established sort of a wall of separation, and that now the majority view on the U.S. Supreme Court is sort of neutral, the statute is neutral and provides benefits to any school, and that if an individual has the choice of where those benefits flow, that it's constitutional. That seems to be the prevailing view now. Is that, is that an accurate description of what happened with the law in the U.S. Supreme Court?
I believe, Your Honor, that you stated it very precisely, that they look at does it apply to a broad class of pupils. In Nyquist, it was only designed to solve a problem in the religious schools, and the only people that could benefit were those in the religious schools, and they had religious admission tests, which in Ohio we cannot have. The non-public schools that are chartered may not have a religious admission test. In fact, they have to give preference to these children. So we have they didn't have a broad class there in Nyquist. We do in Ohio. It has to be neutral aid, that is a grant, which is neutral, and it cannot be selected on the basis of a religious test. And as you know, what we have here is many children, who are not of the religious faith, entering these schools that are religiously sponsored and getting admission preference as they're trying to help solve their problem. So I think the test that you've enunciated, Your Honor, precisely is where the United States Supreme Court is today.
Thank you, Mr. Young.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Franco.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. I represent the Sioux Gatton plaintiffs. I plan to take 10 minutes, and Mr. Chan, who represents the Dora Simmons Harris plaintiffs, also plans to take 10 minutes. Sitting here and listening to the interesting docket today, I have Chrysler would ask particularly about Ohio's own constitution, over which this court has sovereign authority. And I mean to get to that subject very promptly, because I think it is the first subject to be reached. Initially, however, I want to say, in response to Messrs. Sutton and Young particularly, Nyquist still lives. Nyquist reads exactly on this case. There, the argument of choice was the same as it is here. There it was 85% sectarian, here it's 80% sectarian. And there you will have seen the same arguments that you hear today. The Attorney General in her brief says it's just like the GI Bill, take one and quite. Mr. Sutton said that again today. That was disposed of in Nyquist in one sentence, which is about the reserve. The GI Bill was a bill to add to the compensation of soldiers, sailors, etc., for their service to their country. It was exactly like added salary. And that's why Mr. Justice Powell needed about one sentence to get rid of that subject. Lears is mentioned this morning, it's been mentioned repeatedly. One needs to look at Lears to see how flimsy this argument is, the hope that Lears had somehow made Nyquist go away. You will see that Justice Marshall's opinion begins and ends with Nyquist, and says Nyquist sets the scene and the principles on which we decide this case. And Lears and these other cases they rely on all utterly distinguishable from the court, please.
Would you, I assume you would disagree with my observation to Mr. Young that the view of the Supreme Court as the doctrine on this issue has seemed to change from the, what we call, wall separation to now looking at the neutrality of the funding and the benefits and who it is that directs where the benefits go, how they're used. Would you disagree with that?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. If you read the wall of separation as it was created, not first by Madison and Jefferson, but by Roger Williams, who spoke of the need for a wall of separation between the garden of the church and the wilderness of secular power, and who knew, as Jefferson and Madison did, that the crux of the matter could very well be money. And when you know that money is what we're talking about here, and that Madison used that figure of speech, he said not three pence only should go to religious institutions. If you read the wall of separation in that light, which is the light that is cast on this case, then it hasn't changed.
But there seem to be, don't you agree, there seem to be pronouncements or statements in the more recent U.S. Supreme Court cases that seem to move away from Williams and Rahimi and Madison and so forth, that they seem to be saying that if the field is neutral and funds can go to any number of schools, regardless of whether they're secular or sectarian, and someone other than the state is directing precisely where those funds flow, if it's the parents, that as I read the Supreme Court in the more recent ones, it seems to me they're condoning that sort of condoning constitutionally that sort of program. Is that, you don't read them that way?
Your Honor, respectfully, let me read to you what Justice O'Connor, who is the swing person in these cases, as the court knows, has said about this. She said in Rosenberg, which they cite incorrectly, if I get to that, she said the use of public funds to finance religious activities is still forbidden. She said general assessments in support of religion lie at the core of the prohibition against religious funding. She said our cases, and I think this is important for the write-up today, provide no precedent for the use of public funds to finance religious activities. That, if the court pleases, is the heart of the matter. This case is not about busing, which is okay. It's not about health for kids. It's not about other secular benefits, many of them secular books. This case is about demanding unrestricted monies for a religious institution to use however it wishes for religious purposes, to pay religious clerics, to pay sisters to teach.
Upon the condition that they provide a state-approved education.
Yes,
all right, so couldn't we just as easily say that the amount of money, little as it is going for the purpose of the instruction that is required by the state law, as opposed to reaching and finding that it goes to pay the local priest?
Your Honor, you will know when you read this record that the very genius of parochial education in most parochial schools is that the curriculum is pervaded by religion. And you read those mission statements. We teach arithmetic, we teach reading, language, all in light of the gospel as we understand it. So although the state, without paying for it, says this education meets our standards.
Yeah, but we don't teach math as a Presbyterian or a Muslim.
Pardon?
We don't teach math in the math class that I'm familiar with, for instance. They don't say, whenever you're doing the multiplication tables, that you do it because there's a higher religious purpose.
You do it with Greek religion as a pervasive influence on what you're doing. Your examples are religious. Your underlying thinking is religious. In any event, what I'm saying to the court, with all respect, is that as far as the federal constitution is concerned, no money can go for religious activities. What about the state constitution?
Before you get into the state constitution, I would just like to follow up on a couple of your statements. You distinguished, you said that you could see the difference in providing secular textbooks and busing and those kind of things. But how do you distinguish Withers providing state funds to an individual to become a minister?
The way I distinguish Withers is, in the words of the Supreme Court, we're following Nyquist. And it says, this isn't like Nyquist. Because here, the impact of federal money is attenuated. And they repeat this in several places. The program under which it's given is not skewed toward religion. And skewed toward religion is exactly what Nyquist was about. I'm not sticking at the fact that there was only one way. There could have been eight of them, unlikely. But you have a program across all the choose the religious education.
So then we simply look at the program?
Yes. Your Honor, more importantly, remember, we went back to Washington and was held unconstitutional under their constitution. And I suggest respectfully that readers might well have done the other way under this court's constitution. I want to read to you, if I may, what Attorney General Bricker wrote in an opinion, which we cite in our brief and quote, and which I'm afraid is not mentioned by our friends. Attorney General Bricker said, "No authority exists for the use of public funds for the support or maintenance of any other class of schools than the common schools, that's the public schools, or in any public official, for the diversion or use of any part of public funds intended for school purposes, for schools administered by religious or sects." Now that's the way the Constitution of Ohio reads. No part of school funds can be under the control of any religious institution.
Well, the Ohio Constitution says, Article 1, Section 7, no person shall be compelled to attend, etc. And no preference shall be given by law to any religious society. The Wisconsin Constitution, part there says, nor shall any money be drawn from the treasury for the benefit of religious societies or theological seminaries. Seemingly, an even more stringent standard than the Ohio Constitution and the Supreme Court said the program was okay.
I don't think it's more stringent, Your Honor.
You think ours is more stringent?
I think it is probably at least as stringent, but look at what the Ohio Constitution says about money. No religious, I'm reading from Article 6, Section 2, no religious or other sect shall ever have any exclusive right to or control of any part of the school funds of this state. To me, that reads just like three pence only. And then I say to Your Honors, our friends don't mention the opinion of Attorney General Bricker, and they don't tell why the office has deviated from the view of that distinguished.
Counsel, I'd like to get you to the uniformity clause, or we would both counsel
that. Your Honor, we, neither of us is expert on the uniformity clause, and I am 2 minutes into my co-counsel's time. So
the reference. You're going to fuck that one over.
I would like to, both of us, to use the candor we owe the court, and hope to rely strictly on our briefs for that conception. And I would respectfully refer to the brief to say about everything we have to say. Feeling certain, sticking things in my back, I think it would be appropriate thanking the court for its attention.
Thank you, Mr. Frankel. Thank you.
Yes, yeah. With Mr. Frankel.
Well, before you get to what you want to say, let me ask you about the uniform. Well, clearly, Your Honor, that is not our strongest argument in this case, and with the limited time and the statutory amendment that recently occurred, we are prepared to rely on the arguments in our brief, which we think have merit.
So do you think, I had some questions, I guess Justice Piper did, I thought it was maybe your stronger argument, because I think the U.S. Constitution, the Supreme Court has pretty well set the law, since the Court of Appeals decided the case, they've changed the law so much.
Well, more, if you like that, go
well, with well, I wanted to test you on it.
My view of that was that we had a slam dunk case on that before the law was amended, and I think the Court of Appeals agreed with us. I think you have to look at the amendment in context, and whether it is a change in substance or a change in words. As we argue, it is a change in words. It really does not open this up. It sets a parameter in which you still focus right in on Cleveland, and you end up with exactly the reasoning and analysis of the court.
Let me pursue that. It does seem to be suspect.
I think it is suspect.
The question
is how
how does a state ever take small steps?
Is that a camera over there in that door? God,
before taking a giant step.
You keep in the door.
You can't do something like this.
We do not argue, and in a sense to our position, we are not saying that the uniformity clause prevents the very logical approach to a private pilot program. The flaw here is how you identify the location of your private area. You cannot do it with a stratagem that really is picking one place, which can never apply anywhere else, and say, because we have not used the word Cleveland, but we made it a generic phrase which goes back to Cleveland, we overcome that constitutional requirement. That is what we believe has happened in this case. We believe a legitimate pilot project, which defined the pilot area and those school systems which suffered from the problems that you were seeking to overcome, and allowed others to demonstrate that they had those problems, that they had the needs and they needed the help that the people was getting, could come in under the framework of the statute, it would pass muster under the uniformity clause. That is not what was done. This was a legislative end run, and it still is an end run, legislative end run. So much to say, so little time. Let me respond in the moments I have to the core arguments that the defendants made on religion clauses and on the single subject rule. The defendants say, as to religion, that this program passes muster because it satisfies the two-prong test. It is neutral in the sense that the program treats sectarian and non-sectarian schools the same. And there are intervening parental choices, say the defendants, in the sense that no sectarian school gets a dollar of public money unless the parents choose to send their children to that school. But the defendants misunderstand both concepts. As used by the U.S. Supreme Court, neutrality does not mean that government must, or more importantly, can, treat secular and sectarian activities the same. If it could, government could provide money for spiritual counseling, merely because it provides money for secular counseling. Government could build chapels, merely because it built science buildings. Teachers could pray with their children, merely because they discussed secular subjects. But all of those have been held unacceptable under the Constitution in the cases we cite in our brief. Nor are the defendants on any firm ground with their reliance on intervening parental choice. Defendants suggest that this is no different than the government issuing a paycheck to its employees, and that employee donating a part of that paycheck to a religious institution. But it is very different, because a parent is eligible to receive a paycheck under the scholarship program only if he or she agrees to donate it to one of the institutions, one of the schools that have been identified by the state. Unlike the recipient of a paycheck, they can't take a trip to Bermuda. They can't spend it for whatever they want. Let me give you the analogy. I assume every member of this bench receives a paycheck from the state of Ohio. If with your next paycheck, I gave you a list of 10 stores. 8 of them sell religious articles only. And I said, you can spend that paycheck only in those 10 stores. And by the way, the other two that don't sell religious articles, they're probably out of stock and want to walk anyhow. Then you would have a perfect analogy.
You don't say that the other two schools here are out of stock.
Well, they are in this sense.
It's not what the statistics seem to show.
They are in this sense, Your Honor, because the number of available spaces make it necessary that the vast majority of students do go to those 8 stores that sell only religious articles. There simply isn't enough stock in the other two schools.
This sounds like an argument that could have been made to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Your Honor.
Well, but we have their law now to look. Don't we have to follow what they have said?
You absolutely must, and that's why you must rule for us. And I will tell you why in one moment. This is not what the Supreme Court meant in Witters. When it referred to a program, let me read you a key quote from Witters. It is a program that allows, quote, a genuinely independent private choice from among a huge variety of possible careers, of which only a small handful are sectarian. And the choice, the court says, must be a real choice as to the use of the benefit among truly available options, not illusory options like the case in public schools, which don't play the game, not tutoring in the public schools, which is an option which is totally different in value and purpose, and you don't take all the benefits that the state of Ohio offers to children rolled in a big grab bag and say, take your choice. You focus on the specific benefit at issue in the program. The defendants cite Mueller for the proposition that the Constitution does not turn on a head count of the option chosen by the beneficiaries. But what Mueller says is, you don't count how many people choose from among the available options, but the options must be available. And the only real option that is available here is to use this benefit to send your children to a private school, 80% of which are basically secure.
If this voucher program permitted parents to choose any school, you know, in the Cleveland area, would you be here today? Would they go to Beechwood if they chose?
I'd be here. I'd be sweating a little more. I am there in Vermont. I am there in Maine. And we have one at the lower courts.
But that would make it a little bit different if the parents were not limited to simply the smallest of schools that they are in this
instance. More than a little bit different, John. It would make it vastly different. It would take it out of Nyquist, because what we have here is Nyquist revisited. I was involved in the Nyquist case. I heard every one of these arguments, and every one was rejected. But you say Nyquist is an old case. The court has changed. The court reserves to itself the right to overrule its precedents. Even if this court in the first instance believed that Nyquist would not be decided the same way today, that the reasoning of later cases has undermined its holding, which they haven't, you would still be bound to follow that decision unless and until the Supreme Court went otherwise. That is the teaching of Agassiz.
Were you in Wisconsin, too?
I was in Wisconsin, Your Honor.
And what happened to them? They didn't have to follow the U.S. Supreme Court. Is that because they're a more sovereign state?
Interpretation, Your Honor. But if I could just take one more point on this. If this type of neutrality and parental choice were all that the Establishment Clause required, why bother with about the children? Why doesn't the state of Ohio do with the sectarian schools just what it does with the public schools? Let every child decide where they want to go. And a religious school says, guess what? We have 800 students. They voluntarily chose to come here. So on an average daily attendance formula, the state of Ohio simply sends a check. Why bother with a voucher program? Obviously, the Ohio legislature sees the difference and thinks you can't do it that way. If the defendants believe you can do it that way, I hope they'll explain it to me in the 2 minutes that they've saved for rebuttal. Could I?
One subject rule.
I'd love to speak about that, but that's off course of view.
Shortly.
The question in this case, under Article 2, Section 15D, really is this. It is whether a biennial appropriations bill is exempt from that constitutional requirement. In the long run, I submit to you that the answer to that question could have an impact on the operation of government in this state, that in its own right, is just as important as the constitutionality of this program. The scholarship bill included within it an array of substantive programs which everyone agrees are unrelated. Just to mention them, it's the scholarship program, privatization of correctional facilities, loan guarantees to small business, establishment of a commission on dispute resolution, etc. There can be no doubt that if those subjects were included in a separate bill, you would strike it down as totally unrelated under 15D. The question in this case is whether including them in a funding bill can provide the common linkage. Now, everyone talks about Comcast. What this court said in Comtech is appropriation and support is simply the means by which the act is carried out, and the inclusion of such an appropriation does not destroy the singleness of the subject. We have no problem with that. The issue is not whether appropriation for a defined subject destroys the commonality. It's can the funding provide the commonality when there is no common relationship among the subjects? The answer must be no, because on that reasoning, this court would have to conclude that including healthcare facilities and the licensure of the Medical Council of Canada in the same bill would, contrary to your decision in Hoover, be okay, simply if we put it in a general appropriations bill. You would have to conclude it would be okay to include provisions relating to the state judiciary and local option plebiscites in the same bill, contrary to Hegel, simply if you threw it all into an appropriations bill. And finally, if they put the subjects of a new intentional tort, a child labor exemption, and workers' compensation all in the same bill, contrary to your most recent decision in Voinovich, it would be okay if we just put it in a general appropriations bill. I can discern no principled basis for that type of interpretation of Section 15D.
You've gone well over your time, as you know. Take a minute.
I'm going to speak twice as quickly as I do, but have this straight. With respect to Nyquist, it's not a distinction we're offering, it's a distinction the U.S. Supreme Court is offering. It's the same distinction that Justice O'Connor has offered, the very justice they asked you to look to. In Agassiz, she said this.
Counsel, if the U.S. Supreme Court thinks it must come to the issue,
Your Honor, this court clearly has a duty to interpret the Ohio Constitution independently. We agree with that. What we do not agree with is the argument that the Ohio Religion Clauses go further than the Establishment Clause of the United States Constitution. The fact that this has an independent duty to construe this Constitution could well mean that it goes less far. In fact, that's what I would suggest the Constitution means in Article 1, Section 7, where it says religion is essential to the government. To answer your question, yes, Justice Piper, we still have the obligation to construe those clauses, single subject, and uniformity. So on the federal issue, they've done.
Let's go to uniformity quickly.
Some handshake, Your Honor. I think it's the answer I would give.
That's your best case.
Well, I get two arguments. Substantive is the argument because it's just like substantive in the sense that the law there applied only to companies that were capitalized at more than $1 billion. There was only one such power plant, and that's a lot like this statute. The question, the answer the court gave was as long as the statute could apply to some other entity.
So, are you okay if it's a, I don't know, this week we had more students than any other public school in the state?
Well, if you did it based on numbers, you'd have a different problem because that's less likely to change. But here, Your Honor, the notion of a...
So that wouldn't be okay if you said this applies only to school districts with 50,000 pupils or more.
There you have a form that was legitimate but a substance that was not, because it would be impossible, virtually impossible, for any school district to catch up. We know in this state there have been many desegregation cases, many school districts in the court, or in fact, the Dayton case was...
statute wasn't okay until... modification.
No, Your Honor, I would not say that. There's two things you need. One, you need to show lack of uniformity. As this court indicated in Miller, Stanton, and most recently in Austin, found there's a second inquiry. And that's whether the classification used, even if it applies to just one district, is reasonable. I can't imagine a more reasonable explanation than the one you gave, which is to start with a pilot project in the one area of the state that needs it most. I couldn't agree more with plaintiffs that you should look to the Attorney General's office at all occasions. Their reliance on the 1933 AG opinion, however, is misplaced. The 1933 AG opinion dealt with the direct aid case. Just more to finish one response there.
Very quickly.
In Agassiz, the court said this. Three criteria for primary effect. Does it result in government domination? No way. The government is not involved in how these kids are educated. Does it find its recipients by reference to religion? No, it's precisely the opposite. And is there an excessive time to deny an argument? Thank you, Ron.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The marshal will please enter report.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.